Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 18th of March. This hour, we're going to be looking at the horrendous oil spill off the Gulf of Mexico. The news keeps getting worse day by day. Yesterday, there was concern that the currents are carrying the crude oil as far east as Florida and possibly could go up the east coast of the United States. The president has put together a commission to investigate the oil spill. This is 4 weeks now after the explosion, and we're going to talk about what attempts have been made to stop this spill and why in the world there were not heavy-duty regulations to make sure this kind of thing did not happen, or if it did, there were things in place to make sure that it was contained in some way. We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour. Tyler Priest is joining us for the entire hour. He's a clinical professor of business history and director of global studies at the University of Houston's Bauer College of Business. He's the author of The Offshore Imperative, Shell Oil's Search for Petroleum in Postwar America, and is a member of the Mineral Management Services Outer Continental Shelf Scientific Advisory Committee, which advises the agency's environmental studies branch. We will later this hour be speaking with Mandy Smithberger, who is National Security Investigator for the Project on Government Oversight. Welcoming your phone calls and emails all hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Tyler Priest, thank you very much for being with us. Good morning.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
You say that we have to wait for the results of the federal investigations into the cause of this horrible spill to determine what regulatory changes are needed. How long are those going to take, do you think?
Well, it's not clear. I mean, there are investigations going on right now. We're getting more clarity on what actually happened. So I think it's probably time now to begin thinking and proposing what kind of changes we need.
Mm-hmm.
And there certainly need to be some big changes.
I would imagine. You say that we need to make the safety and environmental management program mandatory. What is that program and why is it not mandatory?
Well, maybe if I could step back a little bit and just talk broadly about what the MMS does, the Minerals Management Service, which is this agency in the Department of Interior that leases federal land and regulates this industry. And this, we've had this program since 1954 when the first federal offshore leasing began. It used to be split between the Bureau of Land Management, which handled the leasing and licensing pipelines, and the U.S. Geological Survey's Conservation Division, which was a scientific geological organization that was given this responsibility to regulate and inspect platforms with really no prior experience, no prior models. So in the history, over the whole history of this industry, the regulatory program has always been trying to play catch-up with the industry. Those two agencies were merged into the Minerals Management Service in 1983 to give the regulatory program a more robust responsibility and authority. But still, I think it's important to know that this is a huge, complex, highly sophisticated industry. The amount of capital and technology applied to it is just staggering. And it's tempting to almost just be awestruck in the presence of what's happening in this industry. Billions of dollars spent on platforms and leasing and drilling. And, you know, I think, and this is true at various points in time over this history, that the technology has outrun the ability of the companies themselves often to manage the risks, and it certainly has outrun the ability of the government to oversee this industry. And so what is needed and what has been needed in the past is to close that gap.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a gap really has opened up, I think, in the very aggressive push into deep water.
I find it just hard to believe, just phenomenal, that you can spend all these billions of dollars, highly sophisticated, as you say, and yet not have a plan for what happens if there's an accident. How can you do that?
Well, I think it's I don't know if it's complacency or hubris or just sort of unlimited faith in the technology. You know, the technology, we get enamored with it and sort of depend on it not to fail. You know, I think there is a degree of hubris that creeps into this that, you know, we can cut corners, we can, I mean, and I'm not sure, you know, there are a lot of things that went wrong at the Deepwater Horizon. Clearly, I think some corners were cut. But again, you know, we need to find out exactly what went wrong. We know that there was probably a problem in cementing the well, and gas got into the well bore, and, you know, the mud was pulled out too soon, and the blowout preventer failed. It was just a series of cataclysmic failures that cascaded upon each other. But, you know, Lee Raymond, the former CEO and chairman of Exxon, once used to tell his people that, you know, on safety, we're just as good as we are today. We're only as good as we are today. And things can change radically if something bad goes and bad happens. And that's what happened here.
Are you surprised that a month has passed now and that BP has tried all these various ways to stop this? You know, we got golf balls, we got a tube going down the mile, we've got that overall container thing that didn't seem to work. And my understanding is that it's being created as we speak, all these solutions.
Well, that's one of the distressing things. The response to this seems post hoc and sort of made up on the spot.
Right.
And there wasn't good risk assessment and planning for the worst case scenario. Obviously now, you know, if this industry is going to get the political consent to keep operating, they're going to have to plan for the worst case scenario. If the containment chamber idea was their first response to something like this, why weren't there several of them already built? You know, these are kind of some things that seem obvious now.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, how many other operations are in place in the Gulf or along the American seaboard? Are there many of them?
Yes. And I think that's one thing people don't really appreciate is the size of this industry. There are 3,500 platforms.
Are you kidding me?
In the Gulf of Mexico.
3,500?
Those are producing platforms. Okay.
Wow.
Some of them are small, sort of casing well protector. They're platforms that aren't even manned, you know, in shallow water, very shallow water. I mean, because this industry's been working since the late 1940s. I think about 1,000 of those platforms have personnel on them. There are 90 exploratory drilling vessels, which is what the Deepwater Horizon was. You have to remember there's several phases, you know, in this industry. Everyone just talks about drilling. Well, drilling's just one phase where you're drilling to find oil, and they use these what they call mobile offshore drilling units. And the Deepwater Horizon was a particular type called a semi-submersible. And so, there are other types. There are jack-up drilling vessels and drill ships. And there are a total of about 90 operating in the Gulf of Mexico, in addition to the 3,500 production platforms. And the Gulf accounts for 30% of our domestic oil production and 20% of our natural gas production. So, I mean, the Gulf is the central and western parts of the Gulf are where almost all the activity is. I think offshore California still has about 23 platforms that were installed much earlier. And then, you know, there are a few up in Alaska, but that's really the extent of the offshore industry in the United States.
So the answer that, if we hope, somebody finds to what's going on with this horrendous spill would then be applicable to all these other platforms, or do they already have emergency plans in place? Obviously, they don't, or they would have shared some info.
Okay, well, there's a lot of things that need to happen as a result of this. I mean, obviously, there needs to be different or new hardware regulations about blowout preventers. And the MMS regulatory program is really focused on that, on hardware issues, compliance with, you know, regulations on the design and installation and operation of hardware components, okay? And it's limited in that way. And you referred to the piece that I wrote for the New York Times online about, you know, voluntary regulation. Well, there's a whole another area that safety industry and safety regulators, not just in offshore but in general, began to focus on in the 80s and 90s. And this was we need to look at procedures and programs. We need to look at safety and the management of safety in a more holistic way, not just compliance-oriented, you know, issues with hardware. We need to look at communication and management of change and you know, coordination problems. And you know, we need to look at broadly. And then the MMS, to their credit and to the industry's credit, some companies came up with a plan in the early 1990s called the Safety and Environmental Management Program, or SEMP was the acronym. And, you know, it had a whole list of these. I think there was maybe 12 things that they wanted every company to do, having to do with, you know, managing their safety and environmental information and performing hazards analysis and training their people and on safe work practices and safe operating procedures and how do you respond in emergencies and how you investigate incidents and record the information. I mean, it was a whole series of things. And the MMS wanted to announce that they were going to make this a mandatory requirement, that each company would have to have a SEMP program. But there was some pushback from the industry and I think within government that, you know, this would be too onerous. And let's instead make it voluntary. And the American Petroleum Institute, the API, developed a couple of recommended practices. They developed these RP documents for a lot of things, and the industry usually follows these. But the MMS, and I don't know who made the decision within MMS or the Department of Interior that, okay, well, we're not going to impose this on industry. We'll make it voluntary. We're going to encourage them to develop these SEMP programs, and a lot of companies did develop them, and very good ones. But not all of them did, and they're varying rigor and quality. And you know, the problem with any kind of voluntary regulation is with enforcement. Even if they do develop it, how do they enforce it? How does the government enforce it? And I'm not sure that if something like this had been made mandatory, if it would have made a lot of difference, but it would have, I think, helped shift the industry away from this sort of just basic compliance mentality to, you know, a more serious and holistic approach to managing safety.
Right. And what's the timeline on this? When was this?
This was in there about 1991.
Okay.
And I think it was made voluntary in 1993. And interestingly, just last year, the MMS issued a Federal Register document, published a series of new rules in the Federal Register, where they were going to take a few elements of SEMP and make them mandatory. Just not the whole thing, but just a few elements. And there was some pushback from industry on this because they felt that this was too prescriptive. It wasn't flexible like SEMP. SEMP was, you know, sort of these broad categories that allowed companies to, you know, implement it according to their own culture and organization. But this new proposal last year was to make just a couple of these things mandatory and very prescriptive. And so the industry, you know, complained, you know, this won't work. Some people in the industry felt that, well, if you're just going to do this, why not make the whole SEMP mandatory? You can't just take certain elements. You need the whole thing has to be implemented.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are people in the industry who would have been comfortable with making SIMP mandatory. And I think they would have felt that it would, you know, this is something the industry needs. So that's one thing that I think needs to happen. President Obama and Secretary Salazar's proposal to split up the MMS, I think, is a good one.
Yeah.
What the government needs is a separate agency to enforce health, safety, and environmental regulation. The MMS itself, its mission is to promote oil and gas development. I mean, its mission is to maximize oil production. You know, it's promotional. And it always has been, I mean, by statute. So, the argument has been made, and I think it's probably a fair one, that the promotional mission of the agency can undermine the regulatory mission of the agency. And so by splitting them up, I think you have better control on some of these regulatory issues.
We have tons of phone calls. Just one final question from me. Can you assess the state of our worry now with this oil spill evidently going into the current here, and there's very deep concern that it's going to hit the Keys and then could conceivably go up the east coast of the United States. How do you contain that?
Well, I'm not an oceanographer or a oil spill response specialist, but we have something in the Gulf called the loop current.
Yes.
And there's, you know, serious concern that the oil will be caught up in this current and that will loop it around the west coast of Florida and around the Keys and then meet up with the Gulf Stream. That's been a concern from the very beginning. I mean, it could be devastating if that happens.
Right. To your phone calls in a moment, remember the number. Our lines are filled right now. It's 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Tyler Priest is with us for the full hour. He is clinical professor of business history and director of global studies at the University of Houston's Bowers College of Business, the author of The Offshore Imperative, Shell Oil's Search for Petroleum in Postwar America. And we'll be with you momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our calls with James from Galena, Illinois. Hi, James.
Hi. I've been listening to your guest. He seems to be very knowledgeable. But the point I'd like to make for your listeners is this has been going on for the last 20-some-odd years. You've got and it went on with the Wall Street mess, no regulations on Wall Street, and you've got the Republican Party and some Democrats, senators, still don't want any regulations on Wall Street. You got the health insurance mess. You got individual senators and individual congressmen that doesn't want any restrictions on health care. Now you've got the oil industry, which is not new. It's happened in the Valdez. It's happened in several other places. And according to the 60 Minutes special the other night, some of the whistleblowers are coming forth and saying BP or IP caused this by deliberately speeding up the changing of the platforms down there and bypassing safety regulations. The industry, it's just like, it seems like to me that the Senate and the Congress and the politicians are for sale in this country. And I don't know what we're going to do about it until we change that. It's sickening. It's sickening. It's what it is.
Professor Priest.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to understand this context that the MMS and other government agencies have been operating in for a long time is we've been in an era where, you know, the dominant political ideology is to shrink the size of government and to deregulate and to roll back government interference with business, and the MMS has sort of, you know, been a part of that. The MMS is the nation's largest landlord. They manage 1.7 billion acres on the Outer Continental Shelf alone. The annual revenues they bring in for the government is second only to taxes, income taxes. I mean, a distant second, but still, it's significant. But the agency itself, I think, is probably understaffed and underfunded. And there's been some distressing revelations about laxity in inspections and various things coming out in the last week or so. We need better regulation, and we can't continue to demonize government like we have, I think, and like the tendency is in the recent year. I mean, I've seen this problem. So the MMS has been sort of, you know, caught in this, and they've had their problems. People charge that they've been too cozy with the industry. They had this ethics scandal in the Denver office and the management of the Royalty in Kind program. They've had problems managing the collection of royalties in the Gulf of Mexico. There is a feeling that they are too close to the industry. And the other point I think the caller made was the cutting corners that you know BP seems to have done, and that's been revealed by the whistleblower and the lawsuit that's arisen from that. And you know, the temptation is always there offshore to do that. There are incredible time pressures. BP was leasing the Deepwater Horizon at a cost of $500,000 a day, and that has always been a problem in the offshore industry. There's so much money at stake, and you know, you got to get the wells drilled and get the production platforms in there and get the production going to recover your costs. And you know, I agree that is something that we need to better address and analyze and regulate.
Is BP a particularly bad actor, or are others potentially as well? Is there
I've never worked at BP, and I haven't really studied them from the inside, but they have had their problems in recent years, and you just ask it, you know, the average person on the street who hears news about the oil industry, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard this. Why does it always seem to be BP? They had the refinery explosion down here in Houston, Texas City, in 2005, where 15 people were killed and scores more injured, and criminal convictions as a result of that. They had a big pipeline leak up in Alaska in 2006. Their giant semi-submersible production platform at a place called Thunder Horse, which is about 40 miles south of where the Deepwater Horizon disaster happened. They put in a giant semi-submersible production platform in 2005, and then when Hurricane Dennis came through, there was a valve failure, and it ended up taking on water and listing, and it almost sank. That's a $5 billion platform. And then once they got it righted, there were problems with the subsea wells, and they had to pull all those out. And now this whistleblower is raising concerns about their Atlantis deep water platform. So, you know, from the outside, it looks like BP is having some certainly bigger and more problems than other companies.
Ray from Milwaukee, hi.
Yeah, that brings up a point. BP and Halliburton are both foreign companies now. Halliburton is based in Dubai. Dick Cheney is the head of Halliburton right now. Maybe we could waterboard the truth out of Dick Cheney, since he thought waterboarding was a great way to get answers. And secondly, most people aren't aware U.S. oil that is drilled off our coasts, only a fraction of it winds up in your gas tank, America. So when you say drill, baby, drill, that oil is actually going into a worldwide pool and then redistributed from there. So we should be saying, nationalize our oil, keep it here in this country first. Then we would have to go overseas to try to charge these people. We'd be dealing with this. It would be in-house.
What's the involvement of Halliburton, Professor Priest? Skip the waterboarding part.
I will forego comment on the waterboarding. But Halliburton is a services company. I mean, they do a lot of things. They're a defense contractor and giant engineering construction company, but they also do the cementing jobs on offshore wells. And there have been some issues with cementing in deep water wells, and there was certainly a problem here. And I don't know, again, you know, who is ultimately liable or at fault, but Halliburton was involved here.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to address the comment about offshore oil as a part of our domestic production. We don't export, actually, oil from the Gulf of Mexico, and all that is consumed in the United States. We are net importers of oil. So the oil that's produced in the Gulf of Mexico actually is consumed here. It's refined along refineries along the Gulf Coast, and it does end up in your gas tank. But the caller was right that oil is a global market, and it's oil doesn't just because it's produced somewhere doesn't mean it's actually consumed there. But in the United States, we are such large consumers that we import 60% of our oil.
And what are the rules on how much of that Gulf we can manage? We have, do you know what I'm saying? How many miles out do we own?
Our marine boundary goes out to 200 miles from the coast.
I see.
And that is, even though we are not signatories to the Law of the Sea Convention, the Law of the Sea Convention basically permits nations to claim a 200-mile exclusive economic zone, where a nation can claim jurisdiction and authority over the economic resources that are produced out to 200 miles. So, and the industry is right almost there at the boundary with Mexico, in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico.
Hmm.
The Shell's Perdido spar platform in 8,000 plus feet of water, which went on production in January, is actually fairly close to that marine boundary.
Also joining our conversation now is Mandy Smithberger. Mandy is joining us by phone. She is an investigator at the Project on Government Oversight, which is a nonprofit organization that has been investigating oil and gas royalty issues since 1997. Her office says the apparent failures of the Minerals Management Service to provide vigilant oversight of offshore drilling are all too familiar to those who have watched them allow industry to walk away with billions of dollars in taxpayer money for years. She has written about the federal government's collection of oil and natural gas drilling royalties for the Multinational Monitor, and she joins us now. Mandy, hello. Thanks for joining our conversation.
Thank you for having me.
And also Professor Tyler Priest. This is Mandy. We introduce you to each other. What about this cozy relationship? What do your investigations show about the cozy relationship between industry and the Minerals Management Service?
You really see two facets of this cozy relationship. One of them is the classic revolving door problem, where you have leadership at the Minerals Management Service and at the Department of the Interior that goes straight to industry following working there. And then you also see that in many cases that the Minerals Management Service makes the determination not to pursue industry on royalty underpayment issues.
Why?
It's not absolutely clear. I think for one of the problems is that the Minerals Management Service has a conflict of mission where they're supposed to be encouraging development. From their perspective, they've seen that really is part of their role is helping industry and really trying to encourage industry's development. And so then when it comes to things like oversight and holding them accountable, it really comes into conflict with that mission.
And the president has talked about having two separate things going on, so there would be an agency that would encourage the industry, and then there would be an agency that truly would be an oversight agency. What's he calling for exactly?
What he and Secretary Salazar are calling for is putting that regulatory side in a separate agency and then putting the leasing and royalties collection office on another side. Something that we're concerned about is that it doesn't, at least it's not yet clear that the auditing function, which is another important oversight function, will be separate from that leasing office. And that's where we have seen for years that there's retaliation and that those auditors are ignored.
Mm-hmm. How many royalties, Professor Priest, are we talking about? Is this a huge amount of money coming into our government?
It's significant. I think the total revenues, annual revenues that the MMS collects in bonuses, royalties, and rentals. Bonuses are the price that companies pay, signature bonus, to obtain a lease. And then the royalties are the percentage of production that the government gets, usually about 12%. And then, you know, a sort of nominal rental fee to work the lease. So it's about $8 billion a year. Now, and the royalty collection issue is a big one, and it goes way back. I mean, even before the late 1990s, the USGS Conservation Division was mismanaging royalty collections for years. There was a special commission created around 1980 or so to look into this, and that's when they created the Minerals Management Service. As a result of problems with royalty collection, and it apparently didn't get a whole lot better. There was, and the royalty issues that emerged in the late 1990s had to do with royalty relief. And this was a piece of legislation passed in 1995 that gave companies relief from paying royalties in deep water as a way to incentivize and encourage deep water development because the costs were so large, and there were supposed to be price thresholds in royalty relief, so that if the price of oil got up to a certain level, then you know companies would have to start paying royalties again. This was really mismanaged. There were leases that were signed without price thresholds. The Kerr McGee actually sued the government, saying that you know that they weren't should not be any price thresholds. There was some problems in actually collecting royalties that the government was owed, and so yeah, it's been a big mess.
It sure sounds like it, Mandy. What do we need to do? Do you believe we don't know the exact cause of this horrendous tragedy, but we may have, and you of all people would have some suggestions of what we have to do right now and should have done yesterday to protect the environment should bad things like this happen?
I think what's really important is making sure that any kind of regulators or oversight officials within the Department of the Interior really have the independence that they need to be able to come to the appropriate findings, and that they have whatever enforcement powers that they need to actually act upon what they find.
Mm-hmm. It is, and you tell me, I've already brought this up with Professor Priest, but I didn't know that there were 3,500 platforms in the Gulf, so it seems to me to be another catastrophe just waiting to happen. But I was just dumbfounded that there wasn't a system in place for, it's just amazing to me. They're trying this, they're trying that, they're trying mud, they're trying golf balls, they're trying containers, they don't know what they need to do.
No, I mean, it is absolutely remarkable. And what you see is that in some ways, because they were pursuing development, they really just weren't looking at what could the possible bad consequences be, and because there hadn't been a spill of this scale in a long time, they thought that maybe the technology was in such a state that they didn't have to worry about it, but this accident has shown that that is not the case.
Right. It sure isn't the case. Here's an email that's come in. We have several of them. The U.S. isn't the only country in the Gulf. Vietnam, Cuba, Mexico, China are drilling, just to mention a few. It's curious that with our technology as sophisticated as it is, we have issues. Are we to believe that these countries have not had issues, or is it that we don't know of past or ongoing problems? We are handcuffing our companies with tremendous regulations while foreign countries receive no oversight with their drilling. Professor Priest.
Well, it does vary widely from country to country. In the North Sea, the UK and Norway have a much stricter prescriptive regulatory program, and the health and safety regulation is separate from the so-called promotional agencies. In the UK, it's called the Health and Safety Executive. So that might be a model, you know, that we could look at. But again, in the North Sea, they don't have nearly as many platforms. It's going to be a tall order to develop a program for 90 exploratory drilling vessels and 3,500 platforms. The North Sea is really in decline as a producing area. There's activity, but there isn't nearly as much activity as there is in the deep water Gulf of Mexico. The other deep water areas of the world are Brazil mainly and West Africa. There was a blowout earlier this year off of Australia, so these things happen. And I should say that many regulators around the world have looked to the MMS as a model and guide. And there's something called the International Regulators Forum that MMS has been a leader in for many years. So I think this is going to cause some real soul searching, not just in the United States, but elsewhere. I think the industry is safer and has a better environmental record in the United States than in a lot of other countries. And if we do move to shut down this industry or to severely limit it in the United States, I'm afraid we're going to be maybe exporting environmental problems elsewhere. If we don't get our oil from the Gulf of Mexico, we're going to get it from the tar sands in Canada, and we're going to get it from Nigeria, where they flare their natural gas into the atmosphere. This raises really sort of a global issue.
Mandy, your thoughts on that?
I would mostly defer to his perspective when it comes to that, but I think we can only control our own natural resources, and when that's the interest that we have at stake, I think we have a responsibility to control those.
Let's go next to Roland from Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi. I certainly agree that we have to do a lot more with regulation, but we have to stop this oil leak right now. It's hemorrhaging into the Gulf. I suggest the following. We should probably set off a small nuclear device to seal up that oil field. We have made clean bombs, and we have clean nuclear devices, and the radiation would be minimal. The only problem I can see is that there would be no profits for BP for some time. Probably the oil field would be shut down for a couple of years. But we could seal that right away if we had the will to do it. Otherwise, we're just wringing our hands and we're not doing anything.
Professor Priest.
I would be really wary about resorting to that kind of solution. I should say that what they're doing is pretty standard practice. It isn't just pulling ideas out of a hat. I mean, this idea of a junk shot, I mean, that has worked in wells before. I mean, it's a sort of standard practice. They're drilling the relief wells. This tube apparently is having some success, although I don't know, to what extent it's having success. But yes, the issue is immediate right now. They have to stop this. I'm sort of at a loss in providing any direction and advice on that. But people feel helpless and really vulnerable as this thing continues to blow.
And we'll welcome more phone calls for both our guests. Our guest this hour, Mandy Smithberger, joining us this half hour, National Security Investigator for Project on Government Oversight, Professor Tyler Priest, Clinical Professor of Business History and Director of Global Studies at the University of Houston's College of Business, the author of The Offshore Imperative, Shell Oil's Search for Petroleum in Post-War America. And here's our email address and our phone number. Email is talk@wpr.org. Phone is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the next hour of our program, Gail Sheehy is our guest. And she is the author of Passages in Caregiving, which details the work that caregivers give and also her giving to her husband, who died in 2008, and she spent many, many years caring for him. All right, let's give this email first to you, Mandy, and then we'll ask Tyler for a response. Until there are some economic consequences to companies equal to benefits they receive, the rape of the environment will continue. The agencies are laughably underfunded, overloaded with underpaid, knowledgeable people who eventually sell out to the companies. They'll get it right if the penalties for getting it wrong are large enough. What do you think? This is from Alan in Stone Lake.
I think while there have been some problems with resources to this agency, I think what has been a bigger problem is how that agency has really put together their priorities, and that you saw when it came to a lot of these inspections that what they really prioritized was inspections that would increase production rather than really ensure safety or production qualities or numbers were accurate. And I think that the bad culture that has been there that has really discouraged those employees that want to hold companies accountable has been much more detrimental to really being able to make them an effective agency.
Would you like to comment on that, Professor Priest?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there have to be penalties for bad operators and continued problems and incidents of noncompliance, the MMS calls it. You could take away leases. You could prevent companies from obtaining leases unless they get their acts together. And I agree there has to be a change at the MMS. I think splitting up the functions, the regulatory functions, is a good start. Another thing that I think needs to be done is we need to probably look at National Environmental Policy Act implementation. The MMS does environmental impact statements for the five-year leasing plan, and it does EISs for lease sales. Apparently, they've been using these categorical exemptions where BP was not required to do a detailed environmental review at the site-specific level. And that has been a big issue raised recently. So I think we need to sort of look at how environmental impact studies are being conducted. What is the purpose of them? I think they tend to be very optimistic in their analysis of the prospects of a spill, and really at a sort of at a not a very detailed level. Maybe we need to place responsibility for doing environmental review in an entirely different agency.
Hmm.
Maybe like NOAA or the Coast Guard or the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Oh, that's interesting.
These agencies whose missions are most vulnerable to a large spill. I mean, this is one direction we could move in.
What do you think of that idea, Mandy?
I think that that's something that's definitely worth considering, that it should be put within an agency where that really is their mission, to make sure that there is environmental compliance.
And do you think BP's lease should be yanked?
I think that you definitely need to look at past performance when you're talking about giving any outsider access to our resources. Our organization actually really looks at contractor accountability on a large scale through our contractor misconduct database, where we catalog instances of misconduct by contractors so that to help the government make informed decisions about contractor responsibility. And BP has numerous instances of misconduct, as the professor mentioned.
Chris in River Hills, hi.
I'd like some perspective, please. I once heard an argument from a conservative, and I don't know where the flaw is in the following argument. It was asserted that on the West Coast, there's an offshore oil leak that is fully natural. No drilling. The oil just simply comes up into the water. What do you know about such a phenomenon? Is this common? Is it rare? Is the amount leaking significant or insignificant? And what should be done about such a leak if these things exist?
All right. Does anybody know about this?
Yes, these are called natural seeps. And it's not just on the West Coast. In fact, there are a huge number of natural seeps in the Gulf of Mexico. And in fact, it may sound like industry propaganda, but it's not. There, until certainly this disaster, there were more oil seeped naturally into the Gulf of Mexico than was spilled by offshore operations. I mean, the big, you find tar balls on the beaches along the Gulf Coast, and most of it comes from natural seeps, tankers, and onshore runoff, not offshore operations. And this is you know, the result of a National Academy of Sciences study. And there's really nothing you can do. Oil does, in oil-prone areas of the world, it does seep and leak to the surface.
And is anything done about that, or does it need to be?
No. Well, no, I don't think there's really anything you can do about it. Maybe there is, but I don't know about it.
Does that answer your question, Chris?
You know, the implied implication that a conservative makes, which is not necessarily my argument, is why worry about, you know, today's big spill? And
I wouldn't go that far.
Pardon me?
You know, the deep water, the spill that we have in the Gulf of Mexico is many, many times what seeps in through natural, you know, sources.
Yes, that's what I was looking for.
Yeah, I think that's an absurd statement to make. But there are natural seeps, and in sort of, you know, in the era when the industry was perceived as being safe, and before the Deepwater Horizon, it was operating with minimal spills and reduced accident frequency. But again, as Lee Raymond said, you're only as good as you are today, and on April 20th, it was a new day.
Right. Thanks, Chris. Rob and Nina, hi.
Yeah, this is absurd that we're even talking about this. This should have been looked into 50 years ago. You know, what's happening with Halliburton is just makes me sick. And giving these people a chance to lease again, unbelievable. This is just unbelievable.
All right, thanks for your comments. Mandy?
I think that we've talked about the fact that there are, you know, these significant problems, and I think it takes a disaster like this for us to really understand how important our regulatory structures are, and that I'm hoping that, you know, this time there is a sustained interest in making sure that they're able to be effective.
Do you think that things have moved exceedingly slowly here, Mandy? A month has passed, which seems to me to be a long period of time, A, to figure out a solution, and B, to figure out where we move from here.
I know that both the government and BP seem to be doing what they can. I don't know enough to be able to really mention the timescale, except to be as concerned as everyone else is.
Yeah. Here's another email that's come in. Let's have this one go to you, Professor Priest. Would you comment, please, on when there was ever a problem on a Norwegian-run rig?
I don't really study the North Sea as much as I study the Gulf of Mexico, there was a problem at the Ekofisk platform in the Norwegian sector. There was an issue there a long time ago, and it was a fairly serious one. But Norway is a very strong regulator of its industry. They have a state-owned company. They're one country that has escaped the resource curse and have imposed very strict safety and environmental standards on what happens in their territorial waters.
And do you imagine that we'll do the same, Mandy, after this?
I think you're definitely going to see a change in standards following this, and you're already starting to see those being put in place.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree, Professor Priest?
Yeah, there are big changes in the offing, and it's hard to predict what's going to happen. You know, there's been a moratorium on new drilling permits. There are a lot of projects that are going forward. I mean, there are billions and billions of dollars already invested in pipelines and platforms and drilling vessels and leases. But who knows what's going to happen, you know, in the aftermath of all this? Are we going to continue to lease at the same rate that we have in the Gulf of Mexico? It looks like President Obama's plan to open up more parts of the coastline may be dead in the water.
I would think so.
And there's big questions that both BP and the other companies involved have to answer, and that the government has to answer, and there's going to be there's got to be some more accountability everywhere.
Thank you both so much for being with us to talk about this incredibly important issue. Appreciate your time and expertise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Tyler Priest, Clinical Professor of Business History and Director of Global Studies at the University of Houston's College of Business. He wrote The Offshore Oil Imperative, Shell Oil Search for Petroleum in Postwar America. We also thank Mandy Smithberger, who is an investigator, and she works with the National Security Investigator with a project on government oversight. She has written about the federal government's collection of oil and natural gas drilling royalties quite frequently, and has spoken on international conferences on this particular subject. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for working hard into the evening to produce this program, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Thanks for your calls, as always. Great conversation coming up following the news.